This is Audible.
Hawaii by James A. Michener. Introduction by Steve Barry. Read for you by Larry A. McKeever. With an introduction read by Fred Sanders.
On a voyage such as this, sexual contact was expressly taboo. But this did not keep the king from gazing often at his stately wife Natabu. And old Tupuna saw to it that Teora got some of his food. And in the heat of day, Tehani would dip a length of tapa into the sea, cool it, and press it over her husband's sleeping form. At night, when the stars were known and the course set, the navigator would often sit quietly beside the vivacious girl he had brought with him, and talk with her of Hawaii or of his youth on Bora Bora. And although she rarely had anything sensible to say in reply, the two did grow to respect and treasure each other. But the most curious thoughts between men and women involved the 12 unassigned women and the 34 unattached men. Perhaps the word unassigned is not completely accurate to describe the women, because some of them in Bora Bora had been specific wives of individual men. But on such an expedition, it was understood that, upon landing, any such woman would accept as her additional husbands two or three of the men who had no wives, and no one considered this strange. So on the long voyage, men with no women began cautiously to do two things: to form close friendships with men who had women, establishing a congenial group of three or four who would later share one woman as their common wife, or to study the unmarried women in an effort to decide which one could most satisfactorily be shared with one's group. So that before the voyage had consumed even 15 days, groups had begun to crystallize, and without anything definite having been said, it was remarkably well understood that this woman and these three men would build a house for themselves and raise common children, or that that husband and wife would accept those two friends of the man into complete and intimate harmony, thus populating the new land. It was further understood that each woman, until she reached the age when children no longer came, would be kept continuously pregnant. The same, of course, was true of the sows and the bitches, for the major task of all was to populate an empty new land. On the 11th night occurred an event which, in its emotional impact upon a people who lived by the stars, had no equal on this voyage. Even the abandonment of Oro had failed to generate the excitement caused by this phenomenon. As the west wind crept constantly northward, it became obvious to the astronomers on board that they must lose, and forever, many old familiar stars which lay below what astronomers would later call the Southern Cross. It was with sorrow, and even occasionally with tears, that Tupuna would follow some particular star which as a boy he had loved, and watch it vanish into the perpetual pit of the sky from which stars no more rise. Whole constellations were washed into the sea, never to be seen again. Although this was cause for regret, it did not occasion alarm, for the men of Bora Bora were exceptional astronomers. They had developed, from careful observation, a year of 365 days, and they had found that from time to time an extra day was required to keep the seasons aligned. Their ritual life was organized around a moon month of 29.5 days, which is the easy way to build a calendar. But their year of 12 months was founded on the sun, which is the right way. They could predict with accuracy the new appearance and subsequent motion of the wandering stars, while the merest glimpse of the moon told them in what phase it stood, for each night of the moon month bore its own special name, derived from the progress of the moon through its cycle. Men like Tupuna and Tororo even knew, by counting ahead 6 months, in what constellation the sun stood. So they were prepared, as they sailed north, to lose some of their familiar stars. Conversely, they knew that they would come upon new stars, and it was with the joy of discovery that they identified the hitherto unseen stars of the north. But in all their wisdom, They were not prepared for what they discovered on the 11th night. Having set their course, they were surveying the northern heavens when the old man saw, bobbing above the waves, a new star, not of maximum brightness like the vast beacons of the south, for the voyagers found the northern stars rather disappointing in brilliance in comparison with theirs, but nevertheless an interesting newcomer. "See how it lies in a direct line from the two stars in Bird with a Long Neck," Tupona pointed out, referring to stars which others called the Big Dipper. At first, Tiroro could not catch the bright star, for it danced up and down on the horizon, now visible above the waves, now lost. Then he saw it, a bright, clean, cold star, well marked in an empty space of the sky. Speaking as a navigator, he said, "That would be a strong star to steer by, when it rises a little higher." Tupuna observed, "We must watch carefully the next few nights to see which pit of heaven it goes into." So on the 12th night, the two men studied the new guidepost. But as dawn appeared, each was afraid to tell the other what he had seen, for each realized that he had stumbled upon an omen of such magnitude that it did not bear speaking of. Each keeping his own counsel, the two astronomers spent the last minutes of darkness watching the new star with an apprehension that bordered upon panic. And when daylight ended their vigil, they licked their dry lips and went to their beds, knowing they would not sleep. It was no more than mid-afternoon on the following day when the two men took their positions to study the heavens. "Stars won't be out for many hours," Tupuna said warily. "I'm watching the sun," Tiroro lied. And when Tehani brought him his water and stood smiling by the mast of Tani, her preoccupied husband did not bother to smile back, so she went aft with the women. Swiftly, at 6 in the evening, and not lingeringly as at Bora Bora, the sun left the sky and the stars began to appear. There were the 7 little eyes blessing the canoe, and later 3 in a row, now well to the south, and the very bright stars of Tahiti. But what the men watched was only the strange new star. There it was, and for 9 hours the two astronomers studied it, unwilling to come to the conclusion that was inescapable. But when they had triangulated the sky in every known way, when they had proved their frightening thesis beyond doubt, they were forced, each working by himself, to the terrifying conclusion. It was Tupuna who put it into words. "The new star does not move." "It is fixed," Tiroro agreed. The two men used these words in a new meaning. They had always spoken of the bright wandering stars that moved in and out of the constellations like beautiful girls at a dance, and they had contrasted these with the stars of fixed position. But they realized that, in a grand sense, the latter also moved, rising out of pits in the east and falling into the pits of the west. Some who hurried around the Southern Cross rose from one pit and quickly dropped into another, and there were even a few that never disappeared below the waves. But all moved through the heavens. The new star did not. "We had better consult with the king," Tupuna advised. But when they went aft, they found Tamatoa sleeping, and no man would dare waken another suddenly, lest the sleeper's spirit be out wandering and have no time to slip back in through the corner of the eye. A man without a spirit would go mad. But Tamatoa slept soundly, and his uncle grew nervous, holding as he did the news of the ominous fixed star. "Could you cough?" he asked Tiroro. The navigator did, but with no results. "What would let him know we are waiting?" Tupuna asked petulantly. He went outside the grass house, took a paddle and tapped the side of the canoe, whereupon the king, like any captain who hears a strange noise aboard his ship, rolled uneasily, cleared his throat, and gave his wandering spirit ample time to climb back into his eye. What's happening? An omen of terrible significance, Tupuna whispered. They showed Tamatoa the new star and said, It does not move. Anxiously, the three watched for an hour and then summoned old Teora, advising her, Tani has set a star in the heavens which does not move. What can it signify? The old woman insisted upon an hour in which to study the phenomenon for herself, at the end of which she decided that the men were correct. The star did not move. But how should such an omen be read? She said haltingly, Tani is the keeper of the stars. If he has placed this miracle before us, it is because he wishes to speak to us. What is his message? The king asked apprehensively. I have never seen such an omen, Teora parried. Could it mean that Tani has put a barrier, fixed and immovable, before us? Tamatoa asked. For it was his responsibility to keep the voyage harmonious with the will of the gods. Others could afford to misinterpret omens, but not he. It would seem so, Teora said. Else why would the star be set there like a rock? Apprehension gripped them, for if Tane was against this voyage, all must perish. They could not go back now. And yet, Tupuna recalled, the chant says that when the west wind dies, we are to paddle across the sea of no wind toward the new star. Is this not the new star fixed there for us to use? For many minutes, the group discussed this hopeful concept and concluded that it might have merit. They decided, therefore, that this should be done. Continue for the coming day along the course set by the westerly wind and consult again at dusk, weighing all omens. The four went to their appointed places and discharged their various tasks. But in the remaining moments of the night, Teroro stood alone in the prow studying the new star. And gradually, a new idea germinated in his brain, tentatively at first, like a drum beating in the far distance, and then with compelling intensity. He began softly. If this new star is fixed, suppose it actually does hang there night after night and at all hours. Let's say that every star in the new heavens can be associated with it in known patterns. He lost the thread of some compelling thought and started over again. If this star is immovable, it must hang at a known distance above the horizon. No, that's not right. What I mean is, for every island, this fixed star must hang at a known distance. Start with Tahiti. We know exactly what stars hang directly over Tahiti at each hour of the night for each night of the year. Now, if this fixed star... Again, he was unable to draw together the threads of his thought, but he sensed that some grand design of the gods was making itself manifest. So he wrapped one arm around the mast of Tani and concentrated his entire being upon the new star. If it hangs there forever, then every island must stand in some relationship to it. Therefore, once you see how high that star is, you know exactly how far north or south you must sail in order to find your island. If you can see the star, you will know. You will know. Suddenly, and with dazzling clarity, Teroro saw an entirely new system of navigation based on Tane's gift, the fixed star, and he thought, Life must be sweet indeed for sailors in these waters. For he knew that northern sailors had what southerners did not, a star which could tell them at a single glance their latitude. The heavens are fixed, he cried to himself, and I shall be free to move beneath them. He looked happily to the west, where the little eyes blinked at him prior to dawn, and he whispered to them, The new land you lead us to must be sweet indeed if it exists in such an ordered ocean beneath such an ordered sky. And for the rest of the voyage, through the terrible days that lay ahead, Teroro alone of all the canoe knew no fear. he was sure. He was secure in his conviction that Tunny would not have hung that fixed star where it was except for some high purpose, and he, Teroro, had divined that purpose. Up to now, he had given no one cause to think that he merited his name, the Brain. Certainly, he could never be a knowledgeable priest like his uncle Tupuna, and that was a pity, for priests were needed. Nor had he wisdom in political councils like his brother. But on this night, he proved that he could do something that none of his companions could. He could look at the evidence planted in the universe, and from it derive a new concept. And a greater thing than this no mind can accomplish. On what Teroro foresaw that night, the navigation of the islands ahead would be built, and their location in the ocean determined. In his joy of discovery, Teroro wanted to sing, but he was not a poet. Yet in his very moment of triumph, he experienced an emptiness that had been with him for many days, and which apparently was not going to dissipate. When he finally grasped the significance of the fixed star, he wanted to discuss his concept with Marama, but she was absent, and there was not much use talking about a thing like this with Tehani, for whereas Marama would have grasped the idea at once, beautiful little Tehani would have looked at the heavens and asked, "What star?" It was curious the way in which Marama's last cry persisted in Teroro's ears. "I am the canoe." In a most strange way, she was, for she was the ongoing spirit of the canoe. It was her grave face that Teroro often saw ahead of him on the waves. And when Wait for the West Wind in its swift flight overtook the vision in the waters, Marama smiled as the canoe swept past, and Teroro felt that all was well. Into the arid heat of the doldrums they plunged. The sun beat upon them by day, and the rainless stars mocked them at night. Now not even distant squalls passed with the tantalizing hope that rain might come. They knew it would not. Teroro planned so that Mato and Pa, the two sturdiest paddlers, would not work at the same time. Also, after an hour's stint in the right hull, which tore the muscles of the left shoulder, the paddlers would shift sides and wear out their right shoulders. At each shift, six men would drop out and rest. But onward the canoe went, constantly. From time to time, the stronger women would take paddles, whereupon the shift was shortened to half an hour. While in the bottom of each hull, the artisans and the slaves worked constantly, baling the water that seeped in through the caulked cracks where the pieces of log which formed the hull had been tied together. It was ironic, and a fact remarked by all, that in the storm, when fresh water was plentiful, the sails did most of the work, whereas now, when men sweated and strained endlessly with the paddles, there was no water. The king ordered it to be doled out in ever-decreasing portions, so that the harder the men worked, the less they had to drink. The women, with scarcely any water, suffered miserably, while the slaves were near death. The farmers had an especially cruel task. Tenderly, they would hold open the mouth of a pig and drop water inside to keep the animal alive, whereas they needed the fluid more than the animal. But the death of a farmer could be tolerated. The death of a pig would have been catastrophe. Still, the canoe bore on. At night, Teroro, with his lips burning, would place on the platform near the prow a half-coconut filled with placid seawater, and in it he would catch the reflection of the fixed star, and by keeping this reflection constant in the cup, he maintained his course. At daybreak, red-eyed Teura would sit in the blazing heat, her old body almost desiccated by the sun, and speculate upon the omens. Hour after hour, she muttered, "What will bring rain?" The flight of birds might indicate where islands were and water, but no birds flew. "Red clouds in patches in the eastern sky bring rain for certain," she recalled. but there were no clouds. At night, the moon was full, brilliant as a disk of polished tridacna. But when she studied the moon, she found no ring around it, no omen of a storm. If there were a wind, she muttered, it might bring us to a storm. But there was no wind. Repeatedly she chanted, stand up, the big wave from Tahiti. Blow down, the great wind from Morea. But in these new seas, her invocations were powerless. Day followed day of remorseless heat, worse than anyone in the canoe had ever previously experienced. On the 17th day, one of the women died, and as her body was plunged into the perpetual care of Ta'aroa, god of the mysterious deep, the men who were to have been her husbands wept, and through the entire canoe there was a longing for rain and the cool valleys of Bora Bora, and it was not surprising that many began to deplore having come upon this voyage. Hot nights were followed by blazing days, and the only thing that seemed to live in the canoe was the dancing new star as it leaped about in the coconut cup which Teroro studied. And then, late one night, as the navigator watched his star, he saw on the horizon, lighted by the moon, a breath of storm. It was small at first and wavering, and Mato whispered, "Is that rain?" At first, Teroro would not reply, and then, with a mighty shout, he roared into the night, "Rain!" The grass house emptied. The sleeping paddlers wakened and watched as a cloud obscured the moon. A wind rose, and a light capping of the sea could be seen in starlight. It must be a substantial storm and not a passing squall. It was worth pursuing, and everyone began to paddle furiously. Those with no paddles used their hands, and even the king, distraught with hope, grabbed a bailing bucket from a slave and paddled with it. How desperately they worked, and how tantalizingly the storm eluded them. Through the remaining portion of the night, the canoe sped on, its men collapsing with thirst and exhaustion in pursuit of the storm. They did not catch it, and as the blazing day came upon them, driving the clouds back to the horizon and then beyond, an awful misery settled upon the canoe. The paddlers, their strength exhausted in the fruitless quest, lay listless and allowed the sun to beat upon them. Teroro was of no use. Old Tupuna was near death, and the pigs wept protestingly in the waterless heat. Only the king was active. Sitting cross-legged on his mat, he prayed ceaselessly. "Great Tane, you have always been generous to us in the past," he cajoled. "You have given us taro and breadfruit in abundance. You brought our pigs to fatness and birds to our traps. I am grateful.